Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Hyman. I'm the head of the HILS program on governance here at CSIS. And that very handsome gentleman over on the side in the spotlight is Eric Peterson of the Global Strategy Institute. And on behalf of CSIS, our two programs welcome you here today. And we are partnering today with the World Bank Institute and Transparency International. Not necessarily in that order. Nancy Bosworth is one of the founding members of Transparency International USA, and its president, and on the board of Transparency International. So, Nancy, welcome. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you,
us.
Jerry, and thank you all for coming. Let me add my welcome on behalf of Transparency International and the U.S. chapter. We're delighted to join our colleagues at the CSIS HILS program. The fact that we're so far apart has nothing to do with how close our relationship is. But to come back to you for this very important session, most of us take our daily access to clean water for granted. Yet, as we learn from this work, over a billion people are denied that access due to corruption. Transparency International first focused attention on this challenge in our 2008 Global Corruption Report, which we were pleased to launch with Jerry and CSIS here in Washington last year. That report was the latest in a series of annual reports focusing on corruption in other sectors, including the health sector, judicial systems, and political finance. Our mission in doing these reports and in our work is to draw attention to these systemic problems and also to suggest constructive and multi-stakeholder approaches to addressing them. The chapter here in the U.S. and in 90 countries around the world are engaged with government, with the private sector, and with other civic organizations tackling some of the most difficult challenges of our time. And we hope that many of you who are here today who may not already be working with us will consider how we can partner in addressing them in the days ahead. So today we're fortunate to delve into one of these issues in great detail. We have some terrific experts and speakers with us. So without further ado, Jerry, let me turn the microphone back to you for our panel.
Okay, thank you. Today's session is only one of several sessions this last week or two on water. Those of you who are living in Washington must think we're water-obsessed here in the last week or two. There have been sessions all over town, and that's because the problem of drought, of water scarcity, and of water as a source of conflict has been an animating theme in a whole variety of institutions around Washington projects and in the development community as a whole. And so today last week was Water Week or this week is Water Week or both weeks are Water Weeks, but at any rate, we're in the middle of some kind of water festival. The seriousness of the problem, I think, is evident in these various different sessions and discussions and so on. And we have a panel today. You all should have in front of you their biographies, so rather than take a lot of time with them, Maria Gonzalez de Assis is the Senior Public Management Specialist in the Governance Team at the World Bank Institute, and she concentrates on public sector reform. John Butterworth is a senior program officer at the International Water and Sanitation Center in The Hague. Donald O'Leary is a volunteer senior advisor focusing on, on water issues and a founding member of the Water Integrity Network and has been an animating force behind last year, this year, and the water report, which is, by the way, in the back of the room for your purchase by the World Bank Institute. If you don't have the money today, we have a lending facility immediately outside, and which has been guaranteed by the FDIC. And if after that you still want some, they're for sale at the Infra Shop, which is on the corner of 18th and Pennsylvania Avenue. And the discount that you would receive today will be available for another 4.5 days after today. So go get your report after this. So without further ado, Maria.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for participating in this important event, at least for us. And before I begin, I would like to thank the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and of course, Mr. John Hamre, Mr. Hyman, Mr. Peterson, as well as our partners in producing this book, Transparency International, and of course the Water Integrity Network, in particular Donald O'Leary, John Butterworth, and Pearl June. And especially also grateful to Rafael Vera and Nelson Medina from operations in the water sector in the bank, who are not here today with us because they are working in the field, and the members of our team members in the World Bank Institute, Carolina Baira, Diana Paez, and Chris Hale, with whom we have worked very closely in the field to also to produce some examples, in particular in Honduras and Nicaragua. There are so many other people who contribute to this publication, and they are listed in the slide that you can see and read. I just want to say many thanks to all of them, and forgive me if I am forgetting someone that has been participating also in this important initiative. First of all, let me start by saying what is this book about. This book is about the how of reform, how to build coalitions and identify the priorities for reform in the areas that are very important in the area of governance, information, transparency, and accountability. And it is also about the what to do once the priorities of reform in these three areas on information, transparency, and accountability are identified. And also it's about practical experiences that we combine in the book. Not all of them are there, of course, and I think we can take this opportunity also for sharing other experiences that you know about to illustrate some of the steps in the chain process for cleaning a more clean and transparent and integrity in the area of water and sanitation. So let me just make a few remarks on what I mean by with the how to improve information, transparency, and accountability among all the stakeholders participating in the reform process. This process, as many people know, and all of you probably know, starts with political will, not only from the government, but also from the civil society and from all the stakeholders working in this area. Followed by action planning and prioritizations of reforms by the different stakeholders working in coalitions, monitoring and implementing the reforms, and finally demonstrating the impact. And that's what we are trying to do in the book with the examples that we provide. The problems that are addressed in the book have been identified not by the World Bank, not by the donors, but by the consumers, the service, the civil society, the regulators, the government, the water utility operators, and civil society in a broad range of settings and countries. And as some of you may know, corruption deprives 1.25 billion people of access to drinking water, according to the UN World Water Development Report in 2006. 1.25 billion people. In many water systems, as much as half of the water is accounted for inaccessible by the poor and unsafe. Contaminated drinking water and the lack of basic sanitation services is marginalized. Communities pose a host of health risk, and the high prevalence of diarrhea in children, for example, and stems from the widespread failure to treat water in a proper manner. Many people, as you know, in rural and slum areas lack household connections and must buy unsafe water from vendors at prices far higher than those of tap water. And many who have household connections must still buy drinking water. And in many places, water is available only a few days a week, or a few days a day, or a few days a week. So illegal connections and substantial leakage caused by deferred maintenance have sapped the revenues of utilities, leading to a downward spiral in performance in this area. So other problems that we have encountered and the stakeholders point out in many instances in the workshops that we have been able to do in the countries that we work are and include embezzlement of funds that leads to inefficiency water distribution, bribes to access illegal water connections, manipulation of meter counters, and collusion in public contracts. So when this kind of corruption and problems limits the access to a vital and already scarce resource such as water, I think it's time for collective action. And in this context, the book addresses the process through which coalitions for change can be built the objective of improving information transparency and accountability in the water and sanitation sector. So we try to combine two objectives in the book. The first one, to provide concrete tools to help design, improve, and implement policy reforms to fight corruption in the water sector at the local level, focusing more or less in the local level, although we are bringing the national level as well, and we are trying to bring tools in improving transparency and accountability from other sectors that has been successful and tools that has been successful in other countries to this sector. And second, the second objective is to create an environment in which participants, mayors and other public officials, local practitioners in the water sector, civil society representatives and other stakeholders can work together to develop action plans that will lead to measurable results. So what we do is to present some examples and also our personal experiences in the field, in particular in Honduras and Nicaragua and other countries, that illustrate how important it is to identify, first of all, the key stakeholders for reform. For example, in Honduras and Nicaragua, we work with the country networks, such as the RASJON in Honduras, the water sector planning, CONASA, the regulatory agencies, and so on. And also, we work with various donors who has contributed significantly to these efforts to identify the key stakeholders from the government, the private sector, the civil society, and so on. And that's why also we work in partnership between the World Bank in operations, Transparency International, WIN, and other organizations and networks, precisely to identify the key stakeholders. This is just an example of some of the key stakeholders that are very important to work together towards the design of an action plan for implementation and for the success of the reforms that we are talking about. The water boards, the community leaders, NGOs, academy, government, private sector, probably many others that can work together in coalitions to identify the gaps, challenges, and the tools that they wanted to implement based on these gaps and challenges. So through country examples, what we are trying to do is to demonstrate how coalitions of stakeholders can work together, as I say, to identify the most important challenges in the water and sanitation and to explore how various tools that are used around the world can be adapted to improve transparency and accountability at the local level. Also, we try to shed light on how to conduct capacity development programs. This is very important, in particular, not only for WBI, but for all the work that we are trying to do in the countries that we are working, to ensure that the effective information, transparency, and accountability mechanisms are being supported and institutionalized in an effective manner in the water and sanitation sector. So the book presents examples of, I don't like to say best practices, but at least practices, in some cases successful and in other cases not as much as successful in governance, including among others, for example, the community-owned and managed in Singapore distribution system, Mexico access to information laws, highlighting the use of legal instruments that can be used to defend people's rights. The online bidding system used by the Panama Canal Authority is an exemplary mechanism for transparent procurement. And finally, another one is Colombia's use of integrity pacts as a tool to increase transparency in the water sector. Those examples that you can see there, they are included in the book, except the Agua Tuya in Bolivia, but the rest is included with some practical examples. And the intention is that in each capacity building program that we deliver, they are the stakeholders who decide what are the gaps and the challenges and also the tools that they are going to use and implement in the particular country or in the particular municipality that they are working. And John will be talking a little bit more about these examples in a little detail. We believe our book can serve as a practical guide for those who wish really to build coalitions for reform, and also by providing a better understanding of each of the players. Also, it's important to understand the political economy around each of the players, the regulators, the users of the services, the civil society, the NGOs, to understand the legitimacy, the role, the responsibilities, the potential contributions, and illustrating how best to engage the vulnerable groups such as the urban poor in the whole process of reform. So the process described in the book includes undertaking an initial diagnostic on the governance situation in the particular municipality, and we provide some examples on how identify the vulnerabilities in the areas of information, transparency, and accountability, and collecting this baseline data against which the impact afterwards, after the implementation of the action plans, can be measured. Indicators are developed jointly with and agreed with the key stakeholders, and after completing the diagnostic exercise, the coalitions can then select the specific tools to address the identified gaps and challenges. The tools that are explained in the detail in the book are practical country examples on how to implement this tool, and has been implemented, in fact, in the countries that we are talking in the book. So I think the book showcases a number of compelling examples of what effective teamwork and participation programs can achieve when we pair with the political will that I was talking about, not only from the government but from all the stakeholders. We really hope that these experiences described in the book will serve as not precisely as model, but at least as examples for other countries and regions to address their own challenges in the effective delivery of water and sanitation services, as well as to improve governance in the sector, because then we could have a quality service in the water and sanitation sector. So now I have provided you with some really brief remarks on the how, and my colleague Donald O'Leary will speak about the what of improving information, transparency, and accountability. And John will discuss some of the practical examples that are included in the book. Thank you very much for participating here today. And we learn a lot from some of you that are here present with us today. And we learn a lot also ourselves from in the countries that we have been working. So for us, it's a real pleasure to present this book. Thanks a lot.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me at the back? Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege for me to talk to you today about the what of improving transparency, integrity, and accountability in water supply and sanitation, as described in the book that we are launching today. Before going into the presentation, I would like to acknowledge the major contribution of one of the authors, Pierre Young, who unfortunately cannot be with us today. Pierre is currently on an extended mission in Vietnam. As Maria also mentioned, the Water Integrity Network, which has its secretariat at TI's offices in Berlin, has had a major role in this book. Two of the members of the WIN, John Butterworth and myself, are authors, and we are also on the steering committee of the WIN. So as Maria has already pointed out, governance and anti-corruption reform at the local level needs to be backed by political will, open and unequivocal support at the highest levels. And as she also mentioned, when focusing on the water sector, these reforms can be strengthened by forming a multi-stakeholder groups to provide advice, to provide strategic direction, and to monitor progress. And these principles underpin the book and are illustrated in the five major modules. The first module in the book deals with the nature of corruption in the water sector, and it lays out a conceptual framework for understanding how corruption works in the water sector and analyzes the effects of different types of corruption on consumers, institutions, and society at large. The second module, which is entitled Diagnosing Corruption in the Water Sector, Tools and Impact Indicators, discusses how to use internally and externally focused tools to investigate the extent of corruption and the preparedness of service providers and other organizations to prevent it. The third module, which is entitled Tools for Addressing Corruption in the Water and Sanitation Sector, presents a suite of tools that in many cases call for increased participation by civil society organizations in identifying sectoral budget priorities and in monitoring sectoral performance. Improving access to information is a major ingredient in many of these tools. The next module deals with a number of case studies to demonstrate the use of many of the tools in Module 3, as well as some other anti-corruption tools that have led to outstanding sectoral performance in countries as diverse as Cambodia, Panama, and Singapore. And the final module is entitled Action Planning to Address Corruption and Improve Transparency, Accountability, and Access to Information in the Water Sector. The objective of this module is to move from analysis to developing an anti-corruption action plan in water supply and sanitation through a step-by-step approach that synthesizes the major lessons learned in the previous modules. And these steps include, first of all, developing a corruption risk matrix for the sector. Second, selecting and using diagnostic tools for corruption. Thirdly, identification of impact indicators and their baseline values. Fourthly, the identification of anti-corruption tools. Fifthly, developing a detailed anti-corruption action plan, and finally, monitoring and reporting on the anti-corruption plan. An important point in developing the anti-corruption plan is that it draws on tools and strategies that promote good practice in the water sector. An example is performance benchmarking, which uses a broad range of performance indicators that are defined in a consistent manner to allow comparisons between entities that have similar characteristics and also with industry leaders. And we can divide the benchmarking into two broad categories. The first would be service and performance indicators, for example, service coverage, the levels of non-revenue water, and network performance. And the second ones deal with efficiency and financial indicators such as costs and staffing, tariffs, the effectiveness of billing and collection, financial performance, and affordability. And the benchmarking itself allows managers to identify and prioritize key areas for improvement and adapting best practices appropriate for these areas. And it is also a tool for continuous performance improvement that yields benefits when done over a period of time. A final point I would like to make relates to the role of information. In relation to customer care, good utilities seek out opportunities to inform their customers on a timely basis on issues that affect them. These include not only issuing their audited annual reports within the standard norm of 6 months after the end of the fiscal year, but also informing their customers in relation to issues such as service interruptions. In countries and regions where a customer care culture may not be very strong or virtually non-existent, laws relating to right to information can be very useful tools. These laws can be useful to customers to protect their rights to water and sanitation services and can be used to protect against abuses, mismanagement, and corruption in government. And government itself can improve the level of trust of citizens through promoting more openness and transparency in decision making. I would now like to hand over to John Butterworth of the International Water and Sanitation Center, who will talk about some of the major case studies used in the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Donald, and thank you to our host today. Just picking up on where Donald has left off, I work, as Donald mentioned, in The Hague at the International Water and Sanitation Center, and we work mainly on in the area of learning and capacity building, and the area of transparency, accountability, and integrity is one of the areas we focus on. And I think we would argue, and maybe many other people working in the sector, that the water and sanitation sector is particularly bad at learning. It may be partly because we don't do our job properly, but I think also there just isn't enough effort in this area. And this book is a contribution to the area of learning within the sector on the challenges of transparency, integrity, and accountability that I think, as Maria introduced, are particularly big in the water and sanitation sector. It's very, very difficult to estimate what you lose due to corruption, but when people have tried, they come up with rather large numbers. So it's worrying. We also find very little documentation relating to the problems of corruption in the sector. And, of course, there's one kind of documentation that depresses us, where we see problems being highlighted of corruption of all different types. And there's bad news, and we wonder what we can do about it. So there's one track of people working on documenting problems, the investigative journalists, if you like, who are highlighting problems that are occurring within the sector. That's not an area on which we focus. We don't touch the area, really, of investigation and enforcement of problems, although it may be very important. But we work on another area which the book aims to contribute to, which is around building the systems of integrity, accountability, transparency that can prevent corruption. Because, of course, when corruption is in place in an area, in an institution or a location, it's much more difficult to deal with than if you prevented it in the first place. So this is important when we're looking at issues like decentralization and sector reform in water and sanitation. And there are some examples of good practice that I want to highlight that set a standard, I think, for preventing corruption and that can hopefully inspire us in that type of work. The first example is about the private sector cleaning up its act. And this is a story from Colombia, where manufacturers and suppliers of pipes, obviously important for water and sanitation and stormwater, have worked closely with professional associations, the government, and Transparency International to try and tackle the problem of bribery and corruption in their industry. And this is a particular type of self-regulation that was promoted through an instrument called an Integrity Pact, which has already been mentioned and has been used in other sectors, to reduce corruption in the procurement of pipes, procurement being a particularly problematic area, that are, as I mentioned, obviously a very important component of most water and sanitation projects, and one of the large costs is the pipes. And procurement of pipes is vulnerable to practices like collusion in tendering, where companies join together to fix prices that raises costs, and bribery in order to secure contracts. And in Colombia, starting in the 5 or 6 years ago and signing an agreement in 2005, the parties developed procedures to clean up the sector. So they developed indicators, systems for fair procurement, developed indicators to monitor compliance, and set up systems to ensure enforcement. And most companies got involved in this particular initiative, and the people involved claim a 30% reduction in costs of procurement of pipes. That's money that previously went to middlemen who paid bribes to secure contracts. So although it's difficult to get a firm estimation of corruption in many areas, one interesting way you can try and estimate corruption is to take action and then see what your difference is in costs. Of course, there may be other reasons for some of the costs changing as well. And this is a quotation from one of the people involved. "The impact and effect of this agreement will be very strong, since we have never before had a code to guide us on these matters. Now we have parameters for action. Furthermore, the sanctions that have been established are very important. With this agreement, we, the pipe manufacturers, will act differently among ourselves, since the same rules and regulations apply to everybody." What are a couple of the lessons from this story? One is that it was the right time for this initiative. There was really a crisis of confidence in the industry that the problem was so bad that something had to be done about it, because it was hurting the interests of everybody, including the private companies. The other lesson from this initiative that you can read more about in the book was that the right people were available and involved. In this case, the private sector was an important force. Government commitment was also critical, because it was the government sector that was procuring most of the materials. And facilitators also had a very crucial role, in this case Transparency International and the Professional Association of Sanitary Engineers. So the leadership of those organizations and the top management in wanting to do something about corruption was an important lesson. The second example I'd like to highlight from the book is an example, if you like, of a model utility. I don't particularly like the word, but it's a good example of from Singapore, where the public utility board has really established very strong performance in the sector, including a lot of measures to specifically address corruption. Another example of a utility in the region, which is a well-known example for action in the area, is also from Phnom Penh in Cambodia. And these examples show how we can do something about the pervasive problems in many utilities, of which we could highlight a few, where, for example, staff, including senior managers, are often selected because of their political connections rather than their management abilities or technical skills to work in a utility. And even if the managers have the right skills, they often don't have the autonomy and authority to manage properly. We also see lots of problems of overstaffing because of political interference and nepotism. Unions may be strong and not always a force for good. Sometimes they can be a strong force for good as well. Change is hard to negotiate and downsizing is difficult, and a lot of problems of productivity and low staff morale. Utilities may not be able to pay their staff proper market rates in many countries, and staff may have to do extra work to obtain income. And of course, that can be a factor also in corruption, which we see at all levels, from petty corruption, perhaps in relation to meter reading, up to the more grand corruption associated with procurement. And in many utilities, overall, we see a lack of job satisfaction, poor working conditions, and an absence of incentives for good performance. And the Public Utilities Board in Singapore is one example of of reforms to build very strong systems built around the integrity of the staff of the utility. So as well as best practices in human resource management, specific measures to prevent corruption in the case of the PUB include staff training on its code of governance and code of conduct, effective internal control processes, regular audits, and strong and immediate sanctions where cases of corruption are identified. Staff are required to make annual declarations to declare assets and investments, and the declaration of non-indebtedness. There are other examples from the book as well of other kind of organizations taking up these range of measures to tackle corruption. Where there are problems, these are also reported to the relevant national agency, and strong anti-corruption laws at the national level support the board to tackle problems within the water and sanitation industry. And with a good remuneration package for staff, a functional institution, and strong anti-corruption culture, corruption is said to be not an issue in the case of the Public Utilities Board in Singapore. A lot of work has also been done on accountability, both upwards and downwards, including areas like complaint and reporting mechanisms that are accessible to consumers and places to report, one-stop shops to report problems and give feedback. So that's another example that could inspire us. What are some of the lessons from that case? Of course, the context and the enabling environment are important. It's much more difficult in many places where we work than Singapore, where there's a zero-tolerance policy for corruption and a very powerful state. It may not be so easy elsewhere. And also another lesson from this case is that an institution can only be as efficient as its management and the staff that work for it, and that managing people is really key within the efforts to build transparency and integrity and accountability. Thank you.
Come back for comments and questions a bit later, if that's okay. But we have two star speakers that.
Thank you, Jerry. Before we do open the floor for discussion, I'm honored to introduce the leaders of the two partner organizations which collaborated on this important book. You have their bios, and many of you know them well already, so let me be brief and just say that both of them have devoted much of their professional and personal energy to the fight against corruption. Huguette Labelle is in her second term as chair of the TI Global Movement, and she brings to that position almost 20 years of government service in Canada, including at the Canadian International Development Agency. She manages to guide our far-flung movement while at the same time continuing her service on numerous boards of international organizations such as the Union for the Conservation of Nature and the UN Global Compact. We are so pleased that her hectic globe-trotting schedule permitted her to join us today. Let me also introduce Sanjay Pradhan, who has been a friend and ally to Transparency International and to the anti-corruption movement for many years as a World Bank Director of Public Sector Governance, even when the issue was decidedly not popular and not career-enhancing. So we were particularly delighted when Sanjay was recognized for his good work by being selected to be Vice President of the World Bank Institute, where he is continuing to carry forward many aspects of the bank's anti-corruption program. I should say that some of the methodology that the book is based on was put forward by TI back in 1993 in our earliest days of drawing multi-stakeholders together in a country to talk about the problems, do a diagnosis, come up with some shared ways of approaching it, and then try to take a systemic approach going forward. At that time, the bank was not terribly interested either in working on the issue of corruption or on the demand side of governance. I'd like to say that under Sanjay's leadership, all of that has changed, and the bank today is very much a partner both on the anti-corruption agenda, but in particular on the demand, what they will call the demand side for governance, supporting civil society, and the very critical aspect that our speakers have pointed out of access to information. So with that, let me invite both our speakers, please, to come up and address us.
If I go first, it's just because Sanjay hasn't finished having his lunch. So, and he's taking it there so that you can all watch him eat very elegantly. Well, Jerry, I think it's perfectly fine to have an obsession about water. I think you're just right in Washington about this. And thank you very much. I'd like to join others to thank you for having hosted this event today and having stayed the course in terms of our various debates on the issue of water. As Nancy pointed out, Transparency International is a movement. We've got chapters in over 90 countries around the world and growing. This allows us to be grounded in the national reality while at the same time being able to deal with the international situation and get our chapters to learn from each other. And, of course, TI USA has been very instrumental in the early life of Transparency International and has played a very important role not just in the United States but globally as well. We probably could call them, sort of not the godmothers and fathers, but something like that of the OECD Convention and a number of other very important ones. Nancy, I'd also like to join you in saying how we appreciate the work of Sanji. In his previous position, I think when I look at the World Development Report of 2007, The State in a Changing World, I think that that had a very important impact in terms of looking at the importance of governance in a very different way in how countries finish by having greater transparency, accountability, and integrity. Three words that we should find a new word to bring them together, but I have not. So this has been very good, and we're so pleased to see you at the WBI, because the WBI is something that we have partnered with from very early days, and see this not just as a jewel in the crown of the World Bank, but also as a very important institution to do not just the research, but also based on the findings, a lot of the training that is now highly accessible to so many people around the world. So as we focus on water and sanitation, I'm sort of reminded of Wangari Maathai's words in our Global Corruption Report on Water of last year, 2008. And when she says that water is the driving force of all nature, that it is not only essential for our health, our survival, but it's also essential for the workings of our ecosystem, of all our ecological systems as well, and that it shapes our relationships with nature, politics, and economies, and with each other. And it can either contribute to social stability or be highly destabilizing within countries and between countries. And when I look at the Nile and the Zambezi and the Mekong region, you say Aral Sea, and we can name many more. You see how water is not only important in terms of its quality, its quantity, what it does to people's life and livelihoods, but also how it can be a factor of destabilization or social relationship of a more positive kind. And, of course, we have all been saying now for the last period of time that the whole area of corruption is a prerequisite, or tackling it is a prerequisite for tackling the world water crisis, which we are already facing, without all that can happen, of course, with the climate change hazard that is right with us. And I think we were saying last year that about 80% of health problems can be linked to water and sanitation. And that's probably conservative to a great extent. And, the book that is being launched today, this very practical continuation of the work and building on previous work, and make sure that our Global Corruption Report and some of the other pieces that have been done are not just indeed pieces of paper, but that they are translated into very practical ways of dealing with corruption in water and sanitation. But in looking, I found one figure that I found interesting was the Global Water Intelligence, who said that in 2007 they estimated that total worldwide expenditure in water and sanitation to be about $140 billion U.S. dollars. Now, that is what was spent, not what was needed. And I go back, Sanjay, and you probably have this figure better than I do, but several years ago, the World Bank, in one of its reports, had indicated, if I remember well, that there was a need for over $300 billion a year in infrastructure construction. I don't have the exact figure, but it seems to me that it was around that. And, of course, that dealt with not just water and sanitation, but with energy and transportation and so on. But water and sanitation, we know, would be a very important part of that. And here, again, you know, we're not factoring what climate change has begun to do to the whole water area. So, you know, coming to what we are talking about today and why we're here. This, as was pointed out, this book is a collaborative effort of a number of groups, WBI, Transparency International, WIN, and a number of individuals. And I think it's without these individuals, we would not be where we are today. And I think we need to recognize, in addition to comments that have been made by previous colleagues, I think we need to recognize the work of Maria Gonzalez as being very important, because she played the role of initiating this and of managing all the various people that have come together, the various institutions. And I think that her tremendous skills have made it possible for all these people to work energetically together and very constructively as well, and bring this project to good fruition. And I think what's very, very interesting here is that, you know, it takes the analysis, it takes some of the very important case studies of the Global Corruption Report, and now we have a tool that can be used for a variety of ways, of course, certainly in terms of training and capacity building, but I can see all kinds of other children being born out of this particular book. And I was mentioning to Donal this morning that, you know, for example, one could probably very easily develop a simple guide that could go that managers of water and sanitation locally as well as engineers could really use to help themselves prevent, detect, and deal with corruption when it happens. And Sanji, I'm really on my knees here asking WDBI to translate this book very quickly, starting with Spanish, because I think a lot of the work is already done, then French, then Arabic, then who knows, in terms of some of the essential language, because I think it's only in this way that we can reach many more groups and institutions around the world. We certainly will use our network of chapters to promote this book as a tool. And as I mentioned before, you know, this can be so influential in the way, depending on how we're able to use it, to influence national, provincial, and local regulators in the field, lawmakers in the field, inspectors in the field, over and above, of course, the people that are really delivering on the ground. And I think we need to aim for several hundred thousand managers and engineers of local water and sanitation network to be reached within a few years. And this would be just great. So, again, thank you to all of you for being with us today, and especially to the authors who have worked very hard to put this together. And it's, again, a new beginning in terms of being able to reach out and make a difference here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a real, real pleasure to be here. One of the signs of wisdom and maturity is you need glasses. And so this is when you don't have wisdom, these are sort of proxies to help you approximate wisdom. Just a very a great sort of sincere thanks to our hosts, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mr. John Hammer, the Chief Executive Officer of CSIS. Jerry Hyman, a dear friend. We've been collaborating for quite some time. Good, our roads, paths cross again. Director of the HILS Program and Governance. They've invited us here, and I can easily see that it has led to a very thought-provoking discussion. A big thank you to our partners in producing this book, Transparency International. TI has been, I think, almost for a decade for me personally, with Peter Eigen, with Huguet, with Nancy. I mean, has just been, you know, really our strongest partners on the governance work. So I'll come back to that, but a heartfelt thanks to our partners in producing the book. This would not have been possible because of partners coming together as co-authors in a coalition. So Donald O'Leary, Maria Gonzalez, and I want to second Huguet's point. Maria has been a fearless fighter, and as you know, in anti-corruption work, that's what you need. You need people with passion and drive who are fearless, who are willing to take risks, and that's what Maria has done. Pierre Leung, John Butterworth, all the co-authors, thank you very much. A big thanks to Huguet Labelle, chairperson for Transparency International. You know, if you really have to think about how one person can combine elegance and smile with being a tough anti-corruption fighter, I mean, this combination is truly rare. And you get this, you know, our paths keep, crossing in different parts of the world because of a shared passion on this stuff. But in all kinds of forums, I see her with a smile, with elegance, give the toughest messages to people. And it's incredibly effective. But it's really, and to Nancy Boswell, President and CEO for TI, you know, Nancy, really have been such important partners. You know, as we know, whether it's in the water sector or anti-corruption and Transparency in International or anti-corruption in the World Bank, this can often be a lonely path. And the only way you can have impact is by multiplying yourself through partnerships and coalitions. And that's what you really need. And TI has always been there for us. And it's often interesting in the meetings we have had when we've been discussing issues, you realize that we happen to sit in different types of organizations, and organizations are not monolithic. They're different parts of the World Bank group. But when we are talking, we're often talking very similar languages, very similar shared struggles, and so on. So a huge thanks for this. And you know, still on this collaboration point, this has been the outcome of very good collaboration between the water and sanitation sector of the World Bank. I know there are several colleagues from the World Bank, from the Water and Sanitation Group, that are here. Big thanks. In addition to TI, the Water Integrity Network, the International Water and Sanitation Center, and many others. So this in a sense, mimics, this is a microcosm. This kind of partnership is a microcosm of what you want to see in development in the water sector and so on. Just a word on the governance and anti-corruption strategy and the work of the World Bank, which Nancy referred to, Huguet referred to. This has indeed been a long journey inside the World Bank. In many ways, it started, actually, for those of you who don't know, the famous cancer of corruption speech that Jim Wolfensohn made in the World Bank in 1996, that was preceded by a meeting he had with Transparency International. And it was that meeting with Transparency International which was a very important trigger for Jim Wolfensohn making that speech that corruption is a cancer for development, which really took corruption out of the taboo closet, and it was we were able to utter it. The World Development Report was important in 97, but also a lot of things transpired. I remember when I moved back from the field, with Jim Wolfensohn again, we did a consultation with a whole session with TI, with Nancy and others, and Peter Eigen was there. And again, that gave us an additional boost in this area. So we've come a long way. But for those of you who are here from the World Bank Group, we have now a governance and anti-corruption strategy, which is quite unprecedented when you think about it, because this was something which people would talk about in secret tones. You know, you'd talk about, you know, years ago you'd talk about euphemisms like rent seeking, and you wouldn't quite utter the C word. And now look at it, it's one of the mainstream strategies of the World Bank Group. But why this event is so important? this event is important because we are talking about how this manifests itself in every single sector that the bank works in. In the water sector, we have a huge engagement in the water sector. And this, what we have called in the governance and anti-corruption strategy of mainstreaming governance and anti-corruption in the sectors, is so vital. And we know that sectoral objectives can be better met if governance and corruption issues are addressed. And we know that you will achieve the outcomes in the sectors much better if you have greater transparency, if you have more participation and oversight from civil society and other institutions of accountability, and if you have integrity and third-party monitoring. So all of these things that this piece of work brings together is extremely important. Others have talked about the cost of corruption in the water sector. I won't say much about this, but just to say that it's very important to take this governance and anti-corruption, which is sort of a big topic which is sitting out there, and drill it down in individual sectors, which is what this piece of work does. Again, with Transparency International, I think close to a year and a half ago, or maybe it was close to 2 years ago, Ed Campos and I did the book Many Faces of Corruption, which looks at the value chain in each sector. And and TI was a very important partner in many different parts of it and overall. And these are the kinds of approaches. That was a diagnosis. What we are looking at here is action, and that's where we want to go. Just a quick word on the World Bank Institute. So the World Bank Institute is, if you will, the facilitator for capacity development in countries. And what we seek to do, we were traditionally known as the training arm, but if we just do a few thousand training, we're never going to achieve the development results that we want to. But it can be a very critical part of the governance and anti-corruption agenda. And that's because what is constraining achievement of development results in sectors, in key areas? And one of the critical challenges you have is corruption or poor governance more broadly. And if that's the challenge which is constraining results, we need to build the capacity of state and non-state actors to address this problem. And we are the only part of the World Bank that focuses on client learning. That is the unique mandate of the World Bank Institute. We don't, our partners and clients on the ground, they need money, which is what the operational part of the bank gives. They need reports, which other parts of the bank did, but they actually need to build their own capacity to fight these problems better. And that's where the World Bank Institute comes in. We help build country capacity in particular areas. And one of the unique strengths of the World Bank Institute is that it works not just with government, but it works with non-governmental actors. And we have a very mature program, as you know, on parliaments, building capacity of parliaments so that they can oversee budgets and procurement and all the things, public accounts committees, public estimates committees. We work with civil society, building their capacity. I've just chaired a major review meeting on building the capacity of civil society organizations. And we work with media capacity building. So we work, even on the private sector, Georgia Petkovsky has a very good program on private sector capacity building, on ethics, integrity, environmental sustainability, and so on. So we can be very important partners with others in this quest. And it is not just about building capacity of non-state actors and state actors. As this book illustrates, it's about building coalitions. It's about bringing the different actors together, as Nancy put it very well, to together identify what are the problems, how they can come together and combat these problems. Because ultimately, we are dealing with entrenched networks of corruption. No single individual, no institution, no one can battle these problems on their own. Ultimately, it is about coalition building, where different parts come together to tackle these problems. And we can work with different parts of the bank, and certainly with Transparency International and other institutions, the Water Integrity Network and other such players, in building these types of institutions. So we will certainly move, you get, to ensuring dissemination of this work. But I would like to go further and ensure that the kinds of implications that come from work like this and from other pieces of work help actually translate into capacity building programs on the ground, and action-oriented, multi-stakeholder, consensus-building, action programming, and actual action to tackle these problems. that is where we are going to achieve real impact. You can use technology today so innovatively in reaching not just through books and translations, but through electronic learning, through GDLN, which is this video conferencing facility by which we can reach 130 countries. So you can do a lot to wholesale rather than retail, but also then translate it into capacity building programs and into action on the ground. And we stand ready to work with all our partners to help achieve that. Let me just say that I thank you all for coming. That's it? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Okay.
Thank you. We've got some time for questions and answers, but one more thanks, and that's to Elizabeth Cooper, who's been darting in and darting out in the back, but has been the major domo of this event. And so you all owe your lunch to Elizabeth. I see that lunch is the key to good applause. Okay. Any questions, comments, please, in the back. Yes.
My name is Chloe Schwenke. I want to commend you first on a really long overdue book. It's good that this book has come out. But I do have a concern about the balance. And I'll go to an analogy when we look at thinking of Ms. LaBelle's comment about the relationship of water and sanitation to health. Health is, of course, the human condition, unless when it's hit by disease. And we focus, of course, a lot of energies and intense work on combating disease. But one of the most important ways of combating disease is by nurturing health. And what I don't see in this book here is the whole side about how, and well, I saw it a little bit in John's comments, but the whole side of nurturing integrity. You know, I haven't read the book, but I looked in the index and there's nothing there about trust. There's no entry for ethics. There's no entry there for morality. There's no entry there for values. I would say that, you know, a very important part of the human condition in terms of water and sanitation is the amount of integrity that does exist. And I think we do ourselves a disservice to simply say it isn't there and only focus on the corruption. I don't say for a minute that we shouldn't focus enormous energies and attention on corruption and how to prevent it. But to do that well, we have to recognize the integrity that's there, celebrate it when it is there, hold it up as an example when it's there, and find ways to nurture that, to make that stronger. Thank you.
Why don't we take a couple of comments, and then we'll come back to that. Why don't we take this gentleman over here, and then we'll get that gentleman over there.
Thank you. Gene Brantley with RTI International. Thank you. Gene Brantley, RTI International. One comment and one question. I attended an event recently at the Wilson Center where Peter Glick released his report, and he had a long list of action items that needed to be addressed, and right at the bottom there was one, institutional reform. And so I asked him, well, what do you mean by that? What would you, you know, set as priorities? And he responded, well, I don't really know. They need to be reformed at every level in every way. So I want to thank you for making a contribution to answering that particular question on where to start with institutional reform. My question is, in the examples, the case studies that you mentioned, there's only one in Africa, that's Malawi. And I wonder whether TI Africa or IRC or your other regional subunits are focusing, what initiatives you have for focusing this particular initiative in Africa.
Take this gentleman over here, and then we'll stop for a minute and we'll come back to.
My name's Andy Karp. I'm a consultant in the field. It was mentioned, something that I think all of us would agree with, that it's good to have an obsession with water supply. I would add that it would be nice to also have an obsession with sanitation, which is apparently an afterthought. We look here, the title is Water Sector, all the examples of water sector. I look forward to carefully reading the book, but glancing through it here and there, the word sanitation is mentioned, but there's usually it's not even mentioned. It's just like this slide, water sector. We've reached the point where one can proudly stand up and be a champion dealing with the C word. We haven't reached that point for being a champion for the S word, sanitation. We have celebrities around the world that lend their names to promoting a water supply in African villages. There are none out there that I've ever heard of, no celebrities associating themselves with sanitation in developing countries. Sanitation has a, I would argue, a bigger impact on, poor sanitation has a bigger impact on health and environmental degradation than water, which is not to belittle the importance of water. We need that obsession. But we need to emphasize more sanitation. No doubt many, many of these lessons would, on water would carry over to sanitation, but it would be good to see that specifically addressed. Are there differences in how it carries over? What can be done in terms of transparency and integrity and so on in the sanitation sector? So I would add that to the mix. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we get some answers? So we have a question on values and trust, a question on Africa, and a sanitation celebrity. So who wants to take which of these?
I'd like to respond to the question of Claudia Schwanke in terms of nurturing integrity and related values. In my presentation, I emphasize the fact that what we're doing in terms of dealing with governance and anti-corruption is building on good practice in the water and sanitation sector. And any good water utility, as John Butterworth pointed out, is built on trust between the employees of that utility and the consumers. Customer care is a way that people talk about it, but I would support what she says 100%. We do talk about it in the report. I think there are many nuggets of information in there that would support what you're saying.
Sanjay wants to talk about trust.
Well, on integrity, I think Chloe's point is very important. I think, you know, there's a tendency to think of anti-corruption work as primarily involving pressure points to bear on, and there's a stereotype you can make that, okay, these are these corrupt people and you just need to put pressure on them and they'll then behave better. And I think as your point is implying, that's a very simplistic, and I'm not saying that's the approach in the book, I'm just saying as a general point, that's quite important. Because ultimately, when you look at it, there is an issue of ethics and integrity in anti-corruption. It is people serving their own benefit rather than the benefit of the common good. And I think, therefore, recognizing this aspect is extremely important. It's something that we have talked about it in the context of our leadership work, as you know. And it is about recognizing ethics and integrity in various agents of change, whether it's from the state side or the non-state side. You know, you need actually coalitions of integrity to combat entrenched networks of corruption. And in any solution forward, we will have to deal with this issue. And we'll have to recognize that it's not just people, it's not just the negative side, but also the positive side, which is, I think, what you're implying. And to do this, we need to celebrate, as you were suggesting, stories of success. There are people who have taken risks, enormous risks, because they feel it's not just important for delivery issues, you know, but it's important as a matter of what is right. And that is an inherent aspect of this part of the work of anti-corruption more than other parts of work. And so looking concretely, one of the things that in World Bank Institute we want to do is we want to do more work in this area. And Randi Reiterman, who's sitting at the back, she's joining as our new director for innovation and change management, and she's one of those silent crusaders on this subject. She has done a lot in this area. One of the ideas she has is to do a whole compendium, or at least a sort of try to document cases of leaders of integrity, their stories, because these things are very inspirational. But I would say we even go one step further to look in individual sectors of how we can forge networks of leaders of integrity, state and non-state, so that they are emboldened by the fact that they are together and share stories, look at ways in which they support each other. I think that it's going to be very important, and maybe even look for recognition because that's the more positive way of approaching. But I think as an issue, it's extremely important.
Just very brief to complement what they have said. We try to bring about the examples that are a reflection of the how the preventive measures of corruption in terms of what to do on how to improve information, transparency, and accountability as a mechanism for reducing corruption and improving the service delivery. So in this sense, some of the examples in Singapore, in Bangladesh, are reflecting the leadership that Sanjay mentioned, the chain management in terms of their own organization, the codes of ethics that they are using for changing the institution. So I think it's very, very important what you mentioned, and we try to bring it in the book just by examples of what the people are implementing in their institutions.
Yeah, there was the two similar questions. One was about where is Africa, and the other one, sanitation. Would also be, you could also ask, where is the sanitation in Africa in the book? Yeah, I think it is a little bit true. There is work in there on both Africa and sanitation, but I wouldn't read too much into it. Partly the book was put together originally anyway with a bit of a focus on training in Central America because that was where we were starting. But in doing that, we wanted to look for examples everywhere. And we could only work with what we could find, and it depends where things are well documented. So that may be part of the reason why the work in Africa is not so strong there, although now many, many organizations are working on various different initiatives there in anti-corruption. Most of our work is focused on African countries, so it definitely won't be the same for very long. If we were putting this together again now, we would have more cases from other places too. The same is also a little bit true of sanitation. We now have more cases. There are cases in here that are also about sanitation. Many of the utilities we work with are also focusing on sanitation. The issues of procurement are equally about sanitation as water. And I don't think it actually matters too much. When we've done trainings on this topic, we find that the issues in irrigation, in hydropower, in sanitation, in water around corruption are pretty much the same. You find the same kind of examples in all those sectors. So it's useful, I think, to deal with them together.
The only thing I would add on the question of integrity is that, I think that when you can, in a sense, support the development of islands of excellence or find them, and that if they're in sufficiently different places in a country, it's a little bit like oil on water, because you can use them, you can celebrate them, but you can use these people to help the others by twinning to first of all, demonstrate that it can be done and how they have done it, which sometimes gives people ideas. I always remember when I was in CETA, we were working with agriculture in Poland, and we wanted to use a leader, take the worst farm and work with them in making it a model farm that then that individual could help the others around. And he was telling me, after he became very successful in helping others as well in terms of his own farm, this was dairy farming, he said, it's only when I came to Canada and spent 3 weeks with a farmer that I really know what people were talking about. Until then, I mean, you were showing me videos, you were talking to me, you were sending me flyers, didn't make sense. I could not integrate it. It's only when I worked with this person. So I think your point is well taken. The other one is the role of education in the school system in terms of integrity and where you start and how you can start. In terms of Africa, there is quite a bit more happening right now as we speak. So, whether it's Senegal or Rwanda, to name two, or South Africa, in the townships, some of the things that they've succeeded in doing. And the question of sanitation, of course, we know that a lot of waterways are contaminated because sanitation is not working. And so I know that this was, I think, handled very well by some of our colleagues here. So I will not go further.
Lady in the Irish green shirt.
Yeah, Rosalind Hayes. I'm also from Transparency International. A couple of the speakers mentioned that a prerequisite for having programs like this, tools like this, models work, is to have political will at the top and all the way down. Can you comment on how this kind of work can help to generate the political will that will be necessary for it actually to be successful?
John Butler with ARD. I look forward to reading your book. You focused on transparency, integrity, and accountability. There are two other factors I'd like to just mention to the panel, get your reaction. One is regarding pricing, and that is we're facing in so many municipalities in the developing world basically broken utilities. Politicians are unwilling to confront the issue of the fact that they're simply not recovering the cost of those systems. And I think that opens up water suppliers to issues of corruption. They're not being sufficiently paid, and I think that certainly seems to me a major issue. The second is autonomy. I think the two examples that Mr. Butterworth presented, the PUB, the Phnom Penh Water Company, one essential feature is that these are water service providers, utilities that have been basically provided significant autonomy as well as accountability. They've been established as public bodies, public corporations. Their managers are charged with very strict performance standards with incentives built into those standards. Are also charged with they have quite a bit of discretion over their budget. They're accountable for how they spend that money, but they do have more autonomy. So two additional factors that I'd like your response to.
Thank you. My name is Ronald McLean from the World Bank Institute as well. I just was very moved by the lady's comment. And coming from the trenches, I come from Bolivia, and I chair for some time the water company there. I would say that a couple of comments. One, and it's we have to be careful in taking examples like in countries like Singapore or Hong Kong. I did that in my own book. But then I realized that those are both rich and authoritarian. So the kinds of things that you can do in those countries are quite different from what we could do in poor countries, which are basically now with a lot of dispersion of authority or in a lot of democracy, but also very poor. The second thing is that although I agree that the ethical standards and the islands of integrity are very important, you will seldom find people of high integrity ended up heading one of those organizations. And this is logical because the problem is that the system is designed in a way that is prone for corruption. And people who end up heading those institutions usually are part of a larger government or systemic scheme that go there for precisely because it's corrupt prone. So what we have tried to focus with Maria and others in the Institute is to really look at the institutional design. Institutions that are more prone to corruptions or are ones who are less prone to corruptions. And I think that is the emphasis that we should be working with, recognizing that ethics and high morals are very important but are not sufficient in trying to address these problems in our countries. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a couple of confusing thoughts. I agree. This book should have bear children. And what I would suggest is that the first child that we try to bring about is a similar publication on integrity, and taking it integrity from the source, from and develop a conceptual framework with which we can work. Until now, this has never been done. Although this book has a title that starts with integrity. If you go through the book, you see that you do a very accomplished work in anti-corruption, which is something that you eventually, through regulation, can enforce. Whereas when we talk to integrity, that's something we cannot enforce, isn't it? So it requires a different approach. The second child, I would suggest, is some serious research on the suitability of present procurement systems as we deal with them in countries. Even our, these systems are they do not, let's say, bother to link the structure of incentives of industries that this procurement address with the principles of procurement, with sound principle of procurement. A very simple example. We have systems that are based on least cost award of contracts, whereas we know very well that doesn't work anymore. We are no longer in that world. And we know from recent events also that simple market approaches don't function, isn't it? And the other observation in discussing the same issue of integrity is that we have to think how to return discretion to public officers. These least cost selection approaches have deprived the public officer of any discretion. Now we have to know how we bring it back and how we discipline it. That would then complement with the discourse on integrity. It will complicate the issue, but we cannot avoid it anymore. Thank you.
Is this short? Very short.
Very short.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Barbara Friday from RTI International, and I have a very short comment. I think it's important. First of all, I want to congratulate you on the book and the methodology. I think it's terrific. And I think it's important as we look at anti-corruption to realize that it's so multifaceted that as we approach it, we all have to do it from our seats of strength. And the WBI's seat of strength, being in the World Bank, is looking at the institutional side of things and the adult learning side of things. And there are other organizations that focus perhaps better on ethics, not because there's anything wrong with the World Bank, but the World Bank looks at institutions. Moral authorities, churches, and others focus on ethics. If you're looking at money laundering, you're going to look at the Treasury Department. If you're looking at really fighting crime, you're going to look at justice departments and police. So I think we have to caution against having a publication or an approach that is so comprehensive that it can get watered down. And there's nothing wrong with looking at ethics. I think that's absolutely important. But I think each different kind of organization can play to its own strengths and then contribute in that way to moving things forward. It has to be multifaceted.
Okay, why don't we give people a chance? So we have a question on political will, on integrity and pricing, on poor versus rich, on integrity and procurement, and on churches.
Let me just say something, and I have to apologize. I have to run and meet. We have a meeting with my executive directors, so I have to apologize and run. Let me just address the how do you generate political will. It's obviously a very difficult issue because politicians are leaders of institutions will think that the costs outweigh the benefits of doing reforms, either because it's politically too costly or the results are not very visible. I think you can do a few things to help. It won't necessarily solve the problem. First is through exercises such as this book and other such cases to show that it can be done. I think often what happens is that people have such a sense of powerlessness in the face of corruption that there is a sense that why even bother? It, you know, there's the sense of overwhelming odds. And the beauty of examples such as those featured in this book is it tells you it can be done. It tells you it generates benefits which are tangible and costs that can be overcome. So this is one part of generating political will. The second, I think, is to make sure, you know, the other reason why people have a difficult time doing it is because they see it as a lonely task where they'll go put their neck out and they'll get skewered. And if you can facilitate through approaches that are showcased here, multi-stakeholder approaches which bring together others so you develop a compact, you diversify the risks and multiply strength, I think that's the other thing we can do so that you, in the face of powerful vested interests against reform, you build coalitions which can the third aspect is that even though you may have reluctance at the top, and as Rani says, it could be because they're endogenous to the system. You may have leaders who have landed up there because they're products of political patronage. My experience is that even if that is the case, there are sort of champions of integrity at different places in the organization. And it's never monolithic. And one of the favorite examples we've used in the past is the Philippines procurement reform, where as a system it was quite compromised. But ultimately you had reform champions who were in government, in parliament, in civil society, in church groups, in and so on. And we were able to forge, along with other partners, a coalition. So even when there is this resistance, you can actually forge coalitions because there are others who want to make a difference. And this is the point I would make, I guess, to Barbara's point. Absolutely correct. You know, different institutions have different comparative advantages, and I think we need to nurture and build on those. At the same time, we shouldn't silo ourselves either, because ultimately, precisely the point, you need multi-sec. These are multifaceted, but you need multi-pronged approaches to address this. So you want to make sure that in your coalition, there are church groups. Though the Philippines example was church groups and youth groups were involved in that coalition building and so on. And the last point I would say about generating political will is to put some positive incentives of celebrating recognition, do some awards. I mean, at the global level, TI's Integrity Awards. I mean, people don't do that just to get an award, but it's a very positive way. And you can do, not just through awards, you can actually share, recognize people's achievements. And I think that helps a lot. I just close by saying I was recently in Ethiopia to discuss World Bank Institute. And the perennial question was asked, there's a minister for capacity building in Ethiopia, and the perennial question was asked, what does the incentives for any civil servant not to be corrupt given wages are so low? And he said that, you know, the most powerful motivator in his experience, he's been minister for capacity building for 10 years, is not pay, it is recognition. And if you provide people a little bit of recognition for good work they have done, you can actually inspire them, which is more, inspiration is more powerful than motivation.
Briefly, because I probably... 30 seconds. I think procurement is such an important area, and one could have quite a good discourse on this one. There are a number of things that are being done that have been tried now over the years that have been helpful, but it's this is where an awful lot of money leaks out, the big money, whether it's defense, construction. I just come back to the political will question, Rosalind, because it does start there, no question about it. And just to add to the points that Sanjay has made, or maybe to say them again, but the celebration, of course. And one of the things, for example, President Touré in Mali has had the courage to do a lot of major system revamping on revenues in terms of tax. He's quadrupled the revenues of the state in about 4 years just by reforming income tax. There's nothing has changed. You know, there's not more FDI going in or anything like that. And so, to keep repeating it around the world, as I know I've done and a number of others, strengthens his hand. Because a number of heads of states, prime ministers, have said, if there is not the demand inside and outside for making these changes, that we know these reforms, it's very lonely up there. Because you start well as a new government, and then suddenly the forces that have been there, the facilitators of corruption, those who benefit a lot from it, are very clever and very pushy and have a lot of power. So, you know, that demand inside, outside is very important. That's why and of course the sectoral reforms, going back to your point, that sometimes if you can support an area where the country is ready, the government of the country is ready to look at because it's so bad, whether it's customs, health, and others, then I think that can become a bit of a steering engine to get work done in other sectors, especially if it's successful in the way that it's done. Anyway, we could say more about that time. Yes.
A very brief comment about the autonomy of the institutions. I think irrespective of the institutional arrangement, centralized, decentralized, private, autonomous, what these examples show and demonstrate is that coalitions for reform and reforms to strengthen users' rights, enhance stakeholders' participation, and increase transparency in the utility, in the water service, and decision-making can improve the utility performance as a whole and reduce corruption. And that's the important, I think, one of the important messages that we are trying to bring in the book as well. Just very short.
I would just like to respond to the comments of Mr. Butterworth in relation to the question of tariffs in particular and institutional autonomy. I agree wholeheartedly with those comments, and these are things that are woven into the book, that one needs to have a sustainable financial model for the water sector to be able to provide a quality service and to be able to extend the nature of coverage, particularly in urban areas. And we have a story there from Phnom Penh, the capital of a very poor country, where there is a recognition that the financial sustainability is the key to increasing water supply in poor areas, where the cost of quality service is reduced compared to the alternatives that poor people have of buying water on a retail basis. Obviously, any good utility is managed with a certain amount of autonomy, and by selecting good managers and providing proper oversight, these are very important factors in institutional performance.
I think what I wanted to say was the same. I agreed and just had a few comments on that.
I just wanted to make a brief comment in reaction to the very appropriate statement that integrity can't be enforced. I'm not remembering precisely what Martin Luther King said, so I'll sort of try to paraphrase. But he at one point said that brotherhood couldn't be enforced, but that there was a value to laws that would prohibit discrimination and require equal protection. And I think the same is true here. Not to take away from the need for values and integrity and so forth, but if I think about the book and the World Bank Institute operations in the context of the larger bank operations, I just like to say they need, in at least in my view, to be integrated in the sense that bank action to assess corruption risk up front, to make sure that their own incentives are aligned, to pay attention to corruption, not just to having the projects go forward, is critical to making this work. Working with borrowers to make sure, as Donald said, I mean, access to information is pivotal here, and yet in too many countries, access to information is not available. Space for civil society to participate, which is so critical to some of these examples, is not there, and in fact, TI is very much concerned about the ability of its chapters to actually operate in many countries. Many of them are operating under threat. So attention to these kinds of issues. In addition, very little mention has been made of the private sector and ensuring that companies and contractors, lawyers and accountants and so forth are held to proper standards, fiscal transparency. There are a lot of things that the bank can be paying attention to that I think will make this book more apt to be actually implemented on the ground. So just wanted to add that thought.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to the panel. Thank you to TI and to the World Bank Institute and to all of you for coming and for participating. And I think people will be available outside if you want to make additional comments. So thank you very much.